This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of October 30th. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Here's something spooky to think about. Your credit card company is looking for a way to collect what it can before it can't anymore. The new rules governing credit cards will change in February, so the card companies have had plenty of time to think about what they can do before those changes go into effect. But lawmakers want to speed things up. I'm Steve Chiatakis in for Tess Viglin. It's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today.
Perish the poor soul who gets one of those letters in the mail. It'll cost more to carry a balance on that Visa or American Express. Or how about the new fee if you don't carry a balance? While credit card reform is on its way, it can't get here soon enough for some. Meantime, banks are trying to make adjustments as quickly as they can, and that has the ears of Congress. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
John Bartolik is signing the credit card slip at a jewelry kiosk in Washington's Union Station. He just bought a necklace and earrings. He's careful with his card. Still, he got a letter recently from his bank saying his interest rate was nearly doubling to almost 20%. He called to complain and got a lower rate. Still, he was mad.
But still, I was upset with it because I'd been a loyal customer and I'd been paying on time. So,
a lot of loyal customers are upset with their credit card companies. The Pew Charitable Trust just released a report that says advertised interest rates rose an average of 20% in the first half of this year. The rate on some cards jumped to 30%. Pew studied almost 400 credit cards. Nearly all of them imposed penalties that will soon be illegal under credit card reform legislation. Things like jacking up your interest rate for a late payment and never rolling it back, or applying payments to low-interest debt first, so things you charged at the highest rate stay on your bill.
I think maybe the rates are going up now, and they're going up so steeply, in part because the credit card companies are trying to get in before the new law takes effect.
Nick Bork manages Pew's Safe Credit Cards Project. Congress is considering legislation that would move up the credit card reforms to December 1st. Banks say that wouldn't give them enough time to update their computers to comply with the law, even though it was passed last spring. Scott Talbot is a banking industry lobbyist.
I think it would be almost impossible for the industry to comply. We don't have final regulations relating to the specific details of how to implement the new law, and we have computer software and training and disclosures that have to be changed.
Congress is also considering legislation that would freeze interest rates immediately. Banks say that would cut into their profits and force them to lend less money. Talbot defends the interest rate increases. He says they're necessary because so many people are out of work, there's a greater risk they won't pay their bills. But the bank's critics say they're jacking up rates almost across the board. And some card companies are starting to hit consumers with fees because they pay off their cards every month.
Credit cards are the work of the devil.
That's David Parsons, a retiree from Bloomington, Indiana. You guessed it. He got a letter from his credit card company. They're raising his interest rate by 75%.
It's like they're asking the consumer to cover their butts. You know, it's just not the way I think business should be done.
So how do you fight back? Call Congress, says Robert Manning, author of Credit Card Nation.
Americans really need to demand now and put pressure on their members of Congress to enact this legislation sooner rather than later.
And read the fine print on that letter from your credit card company. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
The Denver area transit system is about to get much bigger. Within the next decade, officials there want to add 140 miles of track, 90 new commuter stations. That quadruples what's there now. The Mile High City's ambitious transit blueprint is being hailed by the Obama administration as a national model. But is it all enough to get people out of their cars? Andrea Bernstein from station WNYC went to Denver to find out.
Union Station is a beautifully preserved marble building in downtown Denver. But if you walk around to the back, you'll see a barren field with acres and acres of weeds. Philip Washington, the head of the transit system, sees the future.
All of this, all the way back to those buildings, this is where 8 commuter rail lines will come into. This is also where 3 light rail lines will come into.
Right now, 6,000 passengers a day come through Union Station. But 8 years from now, planners expect as many as 100,000 daily riders. Is that possible? Denver's transit system is a fledgling chick. Light rail started only in the 1990s, with one straight line that ran from downtown to the southern suburbs.
Well, the first line, was called the Southwest Line, was really an experiment.
Tom Clark is with the Chamber of Commerce. He says the challenge for the Denver transit system is to appeal to Coloradans' inner environmentalist. That means they have to overcome their inner libertarian.
The question of whether or not all these cowboys could get out of their pickups, you know, take their guns out of their gun racks and put their German Shepherd in a cattle and ride transit.
For years, that wasn't an option. If you've never been to Denver, it actually sits on a prairie just east of the Rocky Mountains. The city could grow in every direction, and it did. Built on a series of ring roads, the Denver area is now mostly suburban sprawl, 2.7 million people spread across an area the size of the state of Delaware. Brandy Hager lives in Highlands Ranch, one of the suburbs near the end of the rail line. In August, she got a new job with an IT company downtown, close to Union Station. So she made the short drive from her house to her suburban train station and boarded the light rail. At first, she didn't know what to expect.
Like myself, I used to enjoy driving, and now that I have actually done it and realized how convenient and how nice it is, and I don't have to worry about watching the road or anything, I can just sit back, read, listen to my iPod, and relax.
As I talk to Hager, I wonder what it is she liked about driving. She realizes...
nothing.
That fear of the unknown is the enemy of transit planners, says Eric Johnson. He's a professor at Columbia University's Business School and studies how consumers make decisions.
This is a great challenge because what you're trying to do is get people away from the status quo. They've not only been driving, but they've been driving for a very long time.
The American Public Transit Association says taking transit can save households about $9,000 a year, assuming a two-car family can give up one car. But Johnson says the trick is to make clear that the benefits outweigh what he calls the switching costs, which don't always have to do with money.
If I've always driven, I know I don't have to think about when to leave. I just leave. If I switch to mass transit, I have to actually figure out what the schedule is. And that's a cost that's keeping people perhaps from changing.
It's been, you know, at first it's a little bit of a lifestyle change.
Steve Crisman works in public relations for the University of Colorado. He lives, as he puts it, way out in the suburbs, a 20-minute drive from the closest rail stop. Last spring, he and his wife sat down and thought about ways to reduce their carbon footprint.
Just thought I would give this a try, and it does take overall more time, but on the other side of it, I know exactly how long it's going to take me to get from my house to my office versus you never know in this traffic.
There were a record 106 million boardings on Denver Transit last year. Still, there's an awful lot of persuading to be done. Kelly Holcomb was parking her Subaru just outside Union Station, which happens to be a few blocks from her job as a software tester. Holcomb's employer gives her a free transit pass. It's called an eco pass. But she has to get her kids to school.
Mostly just sort of being lazy, though. Been sleeping in.
So you have free transit, but you still drove.
Yeah, I know. Pretty funny.
Even if it's hard to get people to stop driving to work, it's turned out to be surprisingly easy to get them to take the train to the city's sporting venues, all of which have a train stop. Melissa Willey was with her husband and four children in a train car full of hockey fans wearing red and blue Colorado Avalanche jerseys.
Well, we don't have a car big enough for all of us.
Oh, that's a good reason.
And I plan on having a few cocktails. So train, DUI, yeah, way cheaper.
Yeah, well, local officials say, whatever it takes to get people on the train. From Denver, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace Money.
This is the Union Station, our final destination.
Marketplace Money is supported by Becoming Human on PBS. Nova unearths our earliest ancestors to see how they became us. The evolution of evolution. Nova Becoming Human, Tuesday at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. As we approach the holiday season, this is the time of year when charitable giving traditionally heats up. Could be the contagion of the season. Of course, there's also that tax benefit before the end of the year. The Great Recession, though, has taken its toll. And for nonprofits looking for something extra in their stocking, I'm afraid it'll probably be bah humbug. The Chronicle of Philanthropy says 501c3s are expecting donations to drop 9% this year. That's on top of a 6% dip last year. Most of us learn, or don't, the lesson of giving from our parents. Nancy Hammond of Richmond, Vermont, has been watching her 12-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, put some generosity to work.
When Elizabeth was about 3 or 4 years old, we were already having conversations about what things cost. So we set her up with 3 cups, and we labeled them. One was God or church or charity. One was for savings, and one was for spending. Around the holidays, we would see people with their red buckets and ringing their bells, and so we talked about the Salvation Army and what kind of help they provided certain members of our community. And one year, she, on her own, decided to take all of her cups, and she went up to the bucket and started emptying her entire accumulation of money. The savings, the spending, and the charity money all went into the bucket that day. And the Salvation Army lady, she was just waving and giving us a huge smile, and I was just so proud of her that morning.
I think it was my 7th birthday. I was doing like a pen pal thing with a girl in Russia, and one of the information letters said that children in Russia need clothes. So when I sent out birthday invitations, I said, don't bring any gifts, like bring socks. And that's what they did. I don't have the cups anymore. I just have a bank account. I get an allowance, which is $6. If I see something that I want and it's sort of expensive, I usually start saving up for it. But then usually, by the time I've saved up for it, I don't want it anymore.
She's in middle school, and a lot of her friends have cell phones and games and all kinds of things in their own personal computers. And her dad and I sit down and talk with her about what do we really need versus what would just be really nice to have. You know, we can have things for ourselves, but we should also be investing in, you know, other people's needs or investment in the world.
Nancy Hammond and her daughter Elizabeth in Vermont. What are your stories about kids and money? Do you have questions? Submit them at marketplace.org/financialfutures. You'll see the link right there. Some people find the surface on their own after nearly drowning in debt. Others just keep sinking.
Their wages are at risk of being garnished. Their home may be at risk of foreclosure. They owe more than they own. That's insolvency.
The ins and outs and ups and downs of bankruptcy, up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. A few weeks ago, we introduced you to Candy and Russell Hildebrandt. The couple got themselves trapped under a mountain of credit card debt.
Well, at its worst, when we started the program, we were about $106,000 in debt. Most of that was personal credit cards.
They were able to climb out of the black or red hole of debt the old-fashioned way. Russell got an extra job, and they cut back wherever they could. But many of you wrote in to ask why the Hildebrandts didn't just declare bankruptcy. Well, bankruptcy isn't for everyone, although there are a lot of people filing these days, more so than any time since rules changed 4 years ago. We asked Leslie Linfield of the Institute for Financial Literacy who should consider bankruptcy.
They're being sued. They have credit cards that are going to judgment. Their wages are at risk of being garnished. Their home may be at risk of foreclosure. They owe more than they own. That's insolvency. They've tried alternative debt management options, and it hasn't worked out.
Options such as?
So, you know, they may have already tried to do a debt management program from a credit counseling organization. They may have already tried to do a debt settlement program, and that hasn't worked out successfully. They've tried to negotiate with the credit card companies directly, and that hasn't worked. Bankruptcy is typically the final stop in the I'm trying to get out of debt solution. They pick up the phone. They call an attorney.
I suppose a lot of people would fit that description that haven't filed for bankruptcy, right?
Absolutely. And that is one of the things that we discover when we're talking with individuals who are contemplating it. Many Americans will struggle trying to repay humongous debt loads, and they probably should have consulted an attorney much earlier in the process.
There are several types of bankruptcy, but two in particular, Chapter 7 and Chapter 13. What's the difference between the two?
These are the two most common chapters that individuals will file. Chapter 7 is a complete liquidation where the idea is you take all your assets, those are the things you own, the court would sell them off to pay the creditors, and those are the people you owe. Now, there are certain exemptions, so you're not living in a box necessarily. And then the other chapter is a Chapter 13, commonly known as the wage earner's plan. So that implies you have to have some means, a job, to be able to repay your creditors. And this chapter is very popular for those who are trying to keep their home, particularly in a foreclosure situation. And under Chapter 13, you go to the court, you work out a repayment plan, and the creditors do get some payment back on the bills.
What will bankruptcy mean for your credit and finances going forward?
Initially, it has a negative impact on your credit report, and it will show there for 10 years. But as I like to tell people, time heals all wounds. Some things will survive your bankruptcy. You may keep your car, you may keep your home through a bankruptcy. You're going to continue to make those payments. The way a credit score is calculated is it pulls much more heavily from more recent information than old. So as time passes and you're making those payments, it's going to reflect that as current, and that's going to be more positive.
We talk about so many delinquencies and foreclosures and bankruptcies, of course, because of the financial crisis. Will these events, do you think, have that much weight on the credit score?
They definitely will, if you look at it individually. But this is an extraordinary time in our history. And as we look back, I think credit grantors 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they're going to look back at this time in our history. They're going to look at people as a grouping, and they're going to remember this period of time in our history and remember that many people went through a very difficult time period. Creditors in the future will probably be a little more forgiving.
Such a fascinating topic. We thank you for your time. Leslie Linfield, Executive Director of the Institute for Financial Literacy. Leslie, thanks.
My pleasure.
It's time to get a little personal with our listeners. You can call or write in with your personal finance questions. We do our best to give you some answers. Here to help with all that today is economics editor Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
How you doing? And by the way, welcome.
Thank you. First, we have a question from Julia in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
What you got?
Well, I've got some questions about saving for college and paying for college. I went to a how to pay for college seminar, and at that seminar, the leader of the seminar told us that investing in a 529 plan is not necessarily the best idea for middle class families, because colleges, when considering aid, can think of those as the student's asset, meaning that then they would count them as 50%. And then I went home and I read a book that I have on planning for college, and it said that in July of 2009, colleges are going to start considering 529 plans to be the parents' asset, which would mean they would count them at some smaller percentage when they look at, you know, how much we have for to pay for college. So I'm wondering who is right.
All right, Chris Farrell, who's right?
Okay. First of all, you're absolutely right. It will be considered a parental asset, which is 5.64% versus the student. If it was a student asset, it's 20%. I would also disagree that for middle-class families, it's not a good savings vehicle. Part of it is because it doesn't have a very large impact on financial aid. Secondly, the money that you save when you withdraw it, it's free of federal taxes so long as it goes for qualified education expenses. And a majority of states now exempt it also from state taxes. So a 529 is not the perfect investment vehicle, but it's awfully good. But let me add one important caveat to this, which is private colleges can do whatever they want. What we're
right.
talking about is how is it going to be treated by the FAFSA form and by public colleges and universities. But private colleges can do whatever they want. They can consider whatever asset they want. They can treat it any way that they want.
then that just means you have to look carefully at every college you're applying to.
And I guess the bottom line, Julia, would be to just ask a lot of questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Sue, who's in Covington, Kentucky, right across the Ohio River from Cincinnati. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I purchased a life insurance policy, and I paid it up for $1,000 with the Commonwealth Life Insurance Company of Louisville, Kentucky. And since the policy was paid up in 1976, I quite forgot about it. And when I got it out and tried to find the address, there is no longer a local branch of that company, and I wondered how to find them.
So this is the old insurance policy dilemma, huh?
Yes.
I'm surprised the Google or Bing didn't send you in the right direction.
They did not. The policy itself, I have the number and everything, but it just has the city and state.
Well, Chris, you're the insurance guy, so talk to us about it.
Okay, well, there's a couple things that you can do. The main thing is to contact your state insurance department in Kentucky.
Okay.
And they'll be able to find it for you. That's really the simplest thing to do.
Okay.
By the way, the state insurance departments are very helpful, and they probably know the company. Now, I did do, while you were talking, when you mentioned naming a company, I did do a quick internet search. Now, I don't know if this is exactly it, but Commonwealth Life Insurance Company of Louisville, Kentucky was bought by Monumental Life. So, now, I don't know if this is exactly the same company, but my suspicion is that, you know, it's been merged or taken over. So that's why I would contact your state insurance department in Kentucky. That's the first thing you do. Then I just want to just say as a general statement for anybody else who's kind of in a similar situation, the other thing you can do, if you have a large library in town, you can go to that library in the business section, and there's a publication called BESTS, B-E-S-T-S. And what BESTS does is it follows the insurance industry, and every year they have an annual report, and it gives you all the information about the mergers and acquisitions and name changes. And so it's a really good resource for people in your circumstances.
Uh-huh.
But I have a feeling, make a phone call to the Kentucky Department of Insurance. I think you'll get your answer that way.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I will certainly look into this right away.
Now, Chris Farrell, he's pretty fast with the search engine, isn't he, while you're on the phone, Sue.
I can't believe that. That's wonderful.
Sue, thank you for the call.
Well, thank you for answering my question for me.
If you need a little detective work done on your personal finance issue, give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY, or you can write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at our website, marketplace.org. Next up, we've got this interesting email this week from Pat in Wisconsin, who wonders when the right time is to introduce credit cards to kids. Pat's son already uses a debit card to help out with grocery shopping, but the funds are always there to back up the purchase. So the question from Pat is, should Pat take the next step and get him a credit card to teach him how to be responsible with debt, or is that a little too risky?
All right. I, in general, am against younger people having credit cards.
Yeah, where were you when I got my first credit card, Chris? When they were doling them out at the college bookstore.
Exactly. So that's just my general rule. But if you're really good with a credit card and you're willing to work with your youngster, then what do all parents want to do? We want to impart certain habits to our children.
Yeah, values.
One habit is being good with a credit card. It's a habit. So if you're engaged, you're teaching them about money, you know, then go ahead, get them a credit card because you're taking advantage of the fact that your youngster's living with you and you can impart your lessons. If, however, you're not very good with a credit card, then I would just lean toward the discipline of the debit card, the checking account. There's no reason to have a credit card yet.
And whether it's spending, saving, or just getting by, we're here to answer your personal finance questions. Give us a call toll free. 1-877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or write us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back later in the show to answer more of your questions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. These days, a lot of people are talking about saving. That includes teenagers. Yeah, I know. When I was 15, 16 and working in my dad's restaurant, all I could think about was going to the arcade or buying a car and putting gas in it. I didn't have a clue about how to save money or being reasonable about spending it. So how much does the average teen know about money? Andrea Dominic says not much. She's a senior at Wesleyan University and says personal finance is still a taboo subject for parents to broach. They only talk to you about it when you've mismanaged it. In other words, when it's too late.
My friend Amanda Dorenson is one of the most brilliant people I know. But when it comes to managing her money, she's clueless.
I have no idea the exact amount in my checking account right now. I have a paycheck that I'm sitting on that I haven't deposited yet. I have doctor copays that I know are coming up.
Growing up, Amanda remembers her mom showing her how to balance a checkbook. But she was 15 and more preoccupied with her algebra homework than accounting. It wasn't until she went to college and made her first financial blunder that her mom gave Amanda her first real lesson in money management.
I was having a very rough day in November during my sophomore year of college, and I decided to take it out on my mother's credit card at Bergdorf Goodman. I blew $500 on an M by Missoni dress that I absolutely did not need. Let us just say we had to think of a very involved payment plan.
Actually, it's not that surprising that Amanda had to learn about money management the hard way. A survey from Charles Schwab found that only 30% of parents had even bothered to explain how credit card interests and fees work. I make my own confession to Amanda.
Yeah, I find myself kind of confused when I think about who should have been teaching me how to manage my money. I feel like all the people who should have been teaching us about it are pointing fingers at each other. It's almost like sex ed, you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely, because you have the parents saying, oh, well, the school should really teach the kids about sex ed because they're qualified to do it. And the school thinks, oh, no, that's an intimate issue that a family should work out itself.
Sitting there talking with Amanda, I realize I've known her forever. But this is the first time we've really felt comfortable talking about money.
It's funny, you'd think that personal finance would be shared between parents and kids, and yet we have a real strange thing between our egos and money and how much do we earn.
That's Chuck Currier. He teaches economics and sneaks in a little personal finance management at MiraCosta High School in Manhattan Beach, California. We met up at a local mall.
As a kid, I can remember asking my dad, gosh, how much do you make at work? And most kids will have gotten the same answer that I did. I make enough to pay all the bills, or why do you need to know?
Currier says that the modern world's thrown another wrench into the equation.
It's not odd that kids have no idea where money comes from and where money goes at first. It's because we've kind of lost that visual link of dealing hand-to-hand, person-to-person with money.
Turns out Currier was right on the money. We saw a group of teenage girls checking out clothes at Nordstrom's and decided to ask them, so how do you manage your money?
Hi, I'm Connie Weissmuller. I'm 15.
Hi, I'm Christina, and I'm 16.
So, what do you guys know about managing your personal finances?
I know you're supposed to save some and spend some, and, like, give some away to the poor.
Me and my sister both got a credit card, like, 2 years ago, just because they wanted to teach us, you know, how to save our money.
Whoops. I think you have a debit card.
Oh.
That's Connie, reminding Christina that she doesn't have a credit card, but a debit card.
Yeah, debit card. I don't even know what that is, but...
Do you talk to your parents very much about money management?
We never talk about it. We kind of just had to learn by ourselves. If you want to buy something, you save your money, because they never give us money, unless it's for, like, food and stuff.
Come to think of it, that's all my parents taught me. I did learn the importance of making the money I spend, but nobody told me the responsible part is how you manage that money.
You know, I kind of feel really embarrassed that I haven't done a better job teaching you from an early age.
That's my mom, Judy Tonka. I sat down with her one night to ask her, I'm about to graduate from college. Why don't I know how to manage my money?
What I recall is that I tried but you were so empowered by the ability to earn money and fairly decent money, and you were very haughty about it. This is my money. I'm earning it. Please don't dictate to me what to do with it.
I don't remember having that attitude at all.
Well, I do.
When I was 17, I scored a high-paying job as a lifeguard, and eventually I made over $15 an hour.
And I remember looking at your balance, thinking, where did all that money go? I probably did throw a fit, which was not a good way to teach somebody money management.
So I spent hundreds of dollars on lattes and concert tickets. It kind of makes me cringe to think of what else. My mom says I just wasn't ready to learn, but I say, that's no excuse. So I asked Chuck Currier how parents can teach their kids to manage money. He says, don't wait till your kids start earning money. Start by showing them what you do with yours.
All of the things that we see as adults as being very boring can be very, very interesting to kids. Paying my monthly bills is real boring to me. However, when I said to my daughter one day, do you want to see how I pay all the bills and I'll let you write all the checks? Holy cow, she was completely fascinated. Things like that are a big boost in getting a conversation started.
Currier says ultimately, parents just can't wait for teachers to act, and educators can't afford to wait for school officials to fund a personal finance class.
The things that we learn in our life, we don't just learn them in a class at school. You don't just learn them at home from your parents. It needs to be approached on all fronts.
So instead of passing the buck, adults can finally teach young people how to save one. I'm Andrea Dominic for Marketplace Money.
The death of a parent is awful for anyone, especially a teenager. But how about when both parents die and there's a huge mountain of debt left behind?
I started stealing designer clothes from department stores. Guess jeans, Kenneth Cole shoes, Esprit sweaters. No one at school knew how drastically my life had changed.
Keeping up and then quickly falling behind the Joneses. That's coming up later. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Economics editor Chris Farrell is here with us to answer your questions about personal finance. Chris, hello.
Hello. I'm ready for some more questions.
Yeah, well, we have Sam on the phone from San Diego, California. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's your question?
Well, I've got this catering business, and I find myself in a situation where I've got money right now. You know, when I book events, I ask for a deposit, and, you know, people book their weddings sometimes 6 months, up to a year in advance. So, but, you know, that money is going to be needed later to pay for the vendors, you know. But in the meantime, it's just sitting in a regular saving account, business saving account, which really doesn't generate that much interest. And I'm trying to see if there's any better way for me to invest that money to work for me, for my business, without any risk, and where I can maybe use it whenever I need to.
Yeah, you want that money working for you while it's staying put. You want something low risk, but something that'll yield a lot more.
In today's environment, it's really hard to get much of an interest rate where you can make money. And this is really important, is on the fee side. I would take a look at your fees, what you're paying for the services that you're getting, and go shopping at your, you know, credit union, a community development bank, and then maybe a really big bank, just to sort of see what are the different services you can get. And again, what's your net cost in order to get these services?
Chris, what about CDs?
There the question becomes, you can draw on the money. Of course, you pay a penalty. You don't earn as much interest as you thought you were going to get. So, So if you're putting money into CDs, you're getting a higher rate of interest. But if you're constantly breaking that contract,
yeah,
it's not worth it.
All right. Fair enough.
Good, Sam. Good luck to you, and I hope you yield some returns on all that money.
Thank you. It's always helped to make the money work a little more.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, next on deck is Ruth in Hancock, Michigan. That's in the Upper Peninsula, right, Ruth?
Yes, it is.
So what can we help you with today?
Well, I've got a question about my husband's employer. They're offering two new 401k matching options. With option one, if you contribute 5%, then they contribute 10%, and they give you a salary raise of 2%. with option two, if you contribute 7.5%, they match it with an additional 7.5%, and they give you a salary raise of 4.5%. So my question is, does it make more financial sense to take the higher employer 401k contribution and the lower salary raise, or vice versa?
This is like algebra.
Yeah.
Well, now part of it is you can't go wrong. I mean, both of these options are good. You'll pay more taxes with the higher salary. Either way, they're both good retirement plans. So I guess the way that I'd be raising it is that if the 4.5% salary increase allows you to save money in a taxable account and you're not going to be borrowing much except for the main things, I'd be leaning in that direction. If it turns out that it's really not going to affect your lifestyle that much, just going at the 2%, then you'll have the value of the tax shelter during this period of time and really slightly more money in your retirement.
Okay. Sounds fair enough.
We appreciate the phone call, Ruth.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's a nice plan. That's a very nice plan.
Well, Chris Farrell, I want to thank you for being with us today, economics editor for Marketplace. We do appreciate it.
Oh, it's been fun.
Yeah, we're out of time today, but we know you never run out of questions. Give us a call anytime. The number, toll-free, 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or you can write to us through the website, Getting Personal link at our website, marketplace.org. We've focused a lot lately on how to talk to your kids about money, how to teach them to spend, to save, all leading up to a special live show in Portland, Oregon, November 9th. One thing we've learned so far, the parent's role is very important. Now imagine what that's like for the 500,000 kids who are in foster care in this country, in and out of different homes, interacting with different families. That's where Pathways comes in. The program, part of the nonprofit United Friends of the Children, teaches foster kids about living on their own. A couple of weeks ago, I visited one of their apartment complexes in Whittier. That's about 15 miles east of downtown L.A.
Hey there, how are you?
Great.
Good, Steve Chiatakis. Good
Sandra
to meet you.
Sandra Williams.
All right.
Thank you for coming.
Right. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Sandra Williams is a director over at UFC.
We're an 18 to 24-month transitional living program, and we serve foster youth who have aged out of the system. We work with them on budgeting, but we wrap around a number of services around them, career development, and budgeting's within our life skills series. So we do cooking and communication, all sorts of things, and extensive counseling.
The youth who have aged out of the system are over 18, yet those who live here represent only a fraction of the 1,500 or more who leave foster care in L.A. County each year. One of them, Tafari Gonzalez-Aird, is a tall, lanky 21-year-old who's still trying to find his way.
I was in the foster care system for about 8 years, and then I aged out, emancipated. I entered July 30th. I was homeless for 2 months, and they helped me out.
You were homeless?
Big time. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Really, I became homeless because I couldn't maintain, you know, rent, car payment, gas, you know, utilities, cell phone, all this stuff that is considered really basic.
To live here, Tafari and his roommates need to have jobs and pay rent, real-world stuff. But once they're done with the program, Pathways reimburses three-quarters of that money back. Program organizers think of it as seed money for the future. The complex features a manicured lawn and flowers, just like you'd find anywhere else. And in the center, a place to get together. This is pretty much the heartbeat, the nucleus of this whole area. It seems like where everybody congregates and tries to get together and discuss what's going on in their lives, but their finances and about just living real life. And this is the community room that we're walking into right now. Also mandated by the program are once-a-week classes the young people have to attend to learn life skills. This Tuesday session featured personal finance.
Okay, so as we said, today we're talking about budgeting. Who can tell us what a budget is? What do you mean by budget?
Money you have to save and use.
Money that we have to save and use.
conversation is lively, and the students here are eager to make their budgets work. But it's not easy, and you can see it on their faces, looks of bewilderment, confusion. Some have head and hands. Others, like Tafari, are busy punching numbers on the calculator.
Hey, Tafari,
yeah.
You mind if we sit down with y'all in this group for a second?
Sure.
Just sort of observe what you're doing?
Sure.
All right.
So we have a scenario of the person being named Tamara. She's unemployed. She has a 14-month-old daughter and an $80 per month cell phone plan.
These are real-world decisions. Income, credit, placing importance on certain items, all things Tafari and his group will experience from now on.
Does she need a cell phone?
No, she does not. But then she looks at the problem of if she tries to cancel that cell phone, she looks at paying more money out of that monthly budget that she barely has enough to manage everything.
For someone to call her in case something happens, like if she gets a job, she needs to have a cell phone to call.
That is true. I didn't think about it that way. I just wish she had more money to work with. I don't like this exercise.
Okay, guys, a few more minutes. We're wrapping it up.
Let me ask you a question as you're looking through these different personal finance situations. What was the most important thing on that list?
Our groceries.
Groceries?
Right.
What about rent?
Yeah, rent. Well, I have to eat before I pay rent.
There's some logic behind Javon Bronson's thinking.
Well, if you eat, you'll die, and you won't have a place to live.
While teaching the class on this day, Sandra Williams uses an example everyone can relate to. Money in and then out of pocket.
What are some exercises that you think you might be able to do to really have a realistic account of how much money you're spending? To be honest, I know, you know, I have a challenge sometimes. You know, you go to the ATM, you get $20, $40, and then a few days it's gone and you're wondering, where did that money go?
I think that's a question for Javon.
Can you repeat that again?
Javon, what do you think might be helpful to you? You said that, you know, the money's just burning through your pocket, right? So what could be a helpful exercise for you to get a sense of how much money you're spending, and also equally as important, where your money is going? Where are you spending your money?
I don't know. Try to keep receipts.
Exactly. Keeping receipts. How many of you ever keep receipts?
Pathway says there are quite a few success stories. For us, they invited an alum of the program back to talk about big changes in her life. When she came in, 25-year-old Maureen Wan Du says she was going through a very tough time.
When I first came here, I had no kind of experience with being on my own or anything. I don't know how to save money. I didn't know how to do anything. I figured I need to try to learn how to be on my own instead of being dependent and being sexually abused by a family member. So it was time to go.
Maureen, who spent more than a year and a half in the program, graduated back in 2006 and says things got really desperate before she got help.
Honestly, I was the type of person who always failed at everything. So whether it be school, I got into drugs, semi-prostitution, whatever I could do to just get a buck. And just being here, I kind of really didn't believe that I was going to actually graduate from this program. But just like with the encouragement of the staff, and they kept pushing me and saying, you can do it. You can save the money. Yeah, you messed up, but eventually I got it right.
Where did you think you were going to wind up?
Probably like dead, pregnant, with somebody's baby that I don't know, you know.
These days, Maureen is going to nursing school. She has a job working at a mental health facility, and she says she got a fresh start and a savings account. We have some pictures of our visit and more information about the Pathways program at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. When Liz and Diana Welch lost their dad, they discovered a secret about the family finances. They were broke. When Mom died just a few years later, all the siblings, four in all, were sent to live with different family friends. Now adults, Liz and Diana look back and see how their different approaches to money were shaped by this tumultuous time.
My father wore Brooks Brothers suits and Izod Lacoste shirts on the weekends. He only ever drove a Mercedes-Benz. Now whenever I see that good-looking German car, I wonder, what are they hiding? That's because my dad died in a car accident when I was 13 and left my mother with more than $1 million in debt that she never knew existed. I was used to the country club and pony club rallies and looked the part in Ralph Lauren clothes. That all changed. My mom wisely sold our house, and the family moved into the caretaker's cottage on the estate grounds. Mom had been a famous soap opera star. She started auditioning in earnest for a gig that would put food on the table, and she was thrilled to be cast in the soap opera Loving as June Slater, the alcoholic wife of a university dean. Instead of facing our new life, I took after my dad and put appearance above reality. I started stealing designer clothes from department stores. Guess jeans, Kenneth Cole shoes, Esprit sweaters. No one at school knew how drastically my life had changed. But my younger sister Diana barely knew the difference between our family's old life and the new one.
I was 4 years old when my father died and left us in all that debt. So unlike my siblings, I didn't live a fairy tale childhood of luxury or excess. The loss Liz recalls so vividly went unnoticed by me. When we couldn't afford the country club dues, I didn't care. I was happy playing with dirt, literally. I spent hours playing King of the Mountain alone on a big earth pile next to our house. It was our mother's diagnosis with cancer, 1 month after Dad's death, that really changed things for me. When Mom got really sick, I moved in with a local family. I was 7 and stayed with them after she died. They had a huge house, dressed me fancy, and took me to the Bahamas. But I was miserable. I wanted to be with my real family, in our messy house filled with worn antiques, where I went days without brushing my hair and cherished my siblings' ratty hand-me-down teenager clothes. As soon as I could, I returned to a life where wealth was not the center. As a teenager, I wanted to distance myself from the uptight, rich scene I'd been around. At one point, that meant living in a van and vowing never to buy anything new. Meanwhile, Liz kept trying to live the life she had before they died.
A few months after Mom died, I was accepted to Georgetown University. There, I kept up my ruse, spending all the Social Security checks for my parents' death and my waitressing money on clothes. After school, I went to New York, where most of my meager salary as an editorial assistant was spent on clothes. When I became a freelance writer, I resorted to credit cards to keep my wardrobe up to date. My financial strategy? Pay off interest, buy new shoes. I was living a lie, like my father. It took several years to dig myself out of that debt.
It turns out I take after our mother. She was the frugal one, the one who forced us to eat homemade soggy tuna fish instead of McDonald's on road trips. I've spent my adult life thinking I'm taking a stand against consumerism. But who knows? Maybe I'm just cheap like my mom. We worked on this book in Italy and stayed rent-free at a friend's villa. But the trip was still expensive, and as my euros dwindled, I got stressed. One night, Liz suggested dinner at a chic restaurant in Rome. When the check came, I freaked. "We can't keep doing this," I said. "I just can't afford it." "It's okay," Liz said. "It was my idea. I'll pay." Liz has always shown love by buying me things, and I love being treated by her. But that night in Rome, as Liz pulled the Amex from her Prada wallet with its broken zipper, I realized her generosity extended well beyond her means. "You can't afford it either," I told her. She nodded. We split the bill and made the rest of our dinners at home.
Diana morphed from my little sister who I always wanted to spoil to my best friend and peer. I didn't have to pretend for her or for anyone anymore.
Liz and Diana Welch, their new memoir is called The Kids Are All Right, and it's in bookstores now. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the show goes back to school.
Economics curriculum doesn't necessarily specifically call for personal finance in this state.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Tess Vigeland is back next week. Take care.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. American Public Media.